Good evening and welcome to a special King Records edition of The Blues. I'm Lee Hay, and tonight we're going to focus on some of the rockabilly musicians who recorded at King Records and have been inducted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. Rockabilly as a musical genre came into its own in the 1950s, and Sid Nathan jumped on the bandwagon, recording many rockabilly songs at King Records. Some of the musicians you'll hear about tonight include Bill Beach, Bonnie Lou, Charlie Feathers, Rusty York, and Mac Curtis. Randy McNutt talked with Bonnie Lou in our studio on November 26, 2007, and Stuart Holman also sat down with Rusty York here in 2007. Since this interview, Rusty passed away on January 26, 2014, at the age of 78. So let's begin this King Records special with a phone conversation I had with Bill Beach in 2010. Bill Beach was born in Glencoe, Kentucky, 1932. It's a Rockabilly King Records special on the blues. One of the musicians who recorded at King Records in the 1950s was Bill Pig Pants Beach. He was born in Gallatin County, Kentucky in 1932 and started his country music career back in the 1940s. He moved to Cincinnati in the early 50s, where he eventually recorded at King Records. Bill Beach is on the phone to share his stories. He's down in Florida. Let's start with your move to Cincinnati. You were a country music guitarist and singer. And how did you get into the Wurlitzer Music Studios to record?
Going back to my childhood a little bit, I hope if you don't mind, I always like to tell this story and give my grandpa and grandma a little credit. My parents were very poor, sure crop tobacco farmers. So my mother finally wound up going to Cincinnati and getting a job to help make ends meet on the farm. But anyway, I got into the music down in Kentucky. My cousin played a guitar, and when the family would come to visit us, there was a deal back there in those days. If you run out of food, you'd go to your kinfolk's house, you know. Then maybe you get a meal there, and maybe we'd go sometime to somebody's house. But anyway, my cousin carries guitar around in a burlap bag. And I got fascinated with him singing a little bluegrass music and a little country music with it. And he let me borrow it, and I got real interested in it. He showed me three or four chords, and I went on from there. Then I got me a Gene Autry guitar through the mail order here in Roebuck. Then I graduated on up to playing music then with a little neighbor friend named Jimmy Shelton. So we grew up together and played music and got popular all through high school. And in the early parts of high school, we would save up money and get on a Greyhound bus and go up to the Wurlitzer studio there on, Main Street downtown. And they had a recording studio, and for a small fee, you could go in there and see what you sound like. And they also had a nice music store on the first floor. Then one time during the school break, my friend's son-in-law was in the Army, and he was a recruiting officer stationed in Pennsylvania. Well, they liked our music, too, and they talked us into coming up there and spending a month or so with them during the school break. So we got on a train and went up there, and we got in a amateur contest, and there were some people there that had a radio show in New York, Pennsylvania. And then that we were real young, it was kind of a novelty. So we kind of got to doing appearances with them on their radio show. Then we'd do fairs, you know, through the week. And they were also, Sally and Shorty Fincher was their name. And they were in charge of bringing acts in from Nashville to a park outside of town. So we got to meet and see several of the big stars, Manny Pearl, Jimmy Dickens, Tex Ritters, and of course Hank Williams was up there, and Roy Rogers, and several of the big stars. And we had the honor of being the opening act for those big stars, Sally and Shorty's band, which we were a part of. So that was a big thrill.
Did you ever visit or record in the Herzog studio on Race Street here in Cincinnati?
Yes, I did. Back probably right after I got out of service, I recorded there with a bunch of guys I met. Trey Pennington's band, and they played in a little night spot over in Kentucky. And I had written a few songs, and I was trying to get ahead and get a good band behind me. And he was nice enough to give the guys permission to work with me, you know. So that was probably right about the same time that I recorded for King.
Could you talk about the deal you had with Sid and Nathan at King Records?
Well, I had written these two songs, Peg Pants and You're Gonna Like Me Baby, when I was in the Marine Corps from 1952 to 55. Then when I got out of the Marine Corps, I met up with Ray Pennington's band. And then when I got good enough and I got the song the way I wanted it, I went over to the King Record Company. And there was a gentleman in there working for King by the name of Louis Ennis. He used to be on the Midwest Hayride. I think he recorded for King. He had the job of interviewing new talent. I played the two songs, just me and the guitar, for him. And he liked the songs real well. But he said, Bill, we're in between country, hillbilly, and rock now. So I'm going to put you in the rockabilly class. If you will go back home and speed these songs up, then come back over and we'll take a lesson to them. Well, that's what I did. So they decided to record me.
Who were the musicians that you recorded those songs with at King Records?
It was three of the Boyer brothers that played with Ray Pennington and Ray Pennington's band. They told me they flew a couple of guys in from Nashville, but I don't know if they was trying to impress me or not. One played the drums and the other played the bass. And so we recorded it right there at King Records. That was the only recording that I did for King. All the record had been out for a while, and I was going around promoting my record and trying to get a start, and they'd go to the radio stations like yours and have a interview over there and play the record. But I was doing that, and my previous wife came down with MS, and so that kind of put a kink in my music career. I suppose I could have forged ahead, but at the time it hit her pretty hard. Then I couldn't picture myself out on the road and her being home, and had trouble walking, and eventually had to get into a wheelchair and stuff like that. And I felt that I was needed more at home. And another thing, back then I didn't know if this rockabilly thing was going to catch on, you know, so I thought I better get a real paying job. So I sort of gave up the music business on account of that, and got into another profession. And I didn't pick up a guitar after that, probably for about 26 years to mount to anything, and it's just one of those things.
Did you bump into any other musicians while you were at King Records, like Philip Paul or Rusty York or Bonnie Lou?
Yeah, I met Bonnie Lou, Rusty York. I believe back in those days, before I went in the Marine Corps, I had moved to Cincinnati with my mother, and when I got out of high school, then I had a little time there on my hand. I knew I was going to be drafted sooner or later, so I was just more or less hanging out and trying to do what I could. But WCPO in Cincinnati back in those days, when TV first started, I think it was in early 50s, they had a program on television called the Morning Merry-Go-Round, Big Jim Species, and he also had a Noonday Merry-Go-Round. And to best of my memory, I believe Rusty York was on that, along with a fella by the name of Jimmy Williams, who wound up recording for MGM, and the Davis Sisters, Skeeter and BJ. They were from down in around Cynthiana, Kentucky. They wanted exposure. I wanted exposure, and I suppose Rusty and the rest, everybody wanted exposure. Wasn't much money involved. They just wanted to be on TV, just for saying, well, I was on TV, and maybe get a better gig somewhere for doing that.
Your King hit Peg Pants is being reissued, and you've been inducted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. Has most of the attention you've been getting last couple of decades been in Europe?
Yes, it has been. In fact, my daughter Bonnie found out about that. After the record was released, of course, I got quite a bit of royalties. And down through the years, every once in a while, I'd get a check. And then in 2002, after recording the song in 1956, one day I opened the mail and there was a royalty check on it. Then I said, well, this is probably the tail end of everything. You know, then here about a week ago, I got another royalty check. So it's evidently being played over there or somewhere, or they're buying it off the internet or something. But I don't think I get anything for the records that's produced overseas after all these years. But here in the States, I would think, and I guess that's where some of it's coming from.
I read online that you bought a Martin D28 guitar in 48. Do you still have it, and what other guitars are in your collection?
Well, I have the Martin D28 that I bought at that time in 1948, and I bought it at Wurlitzer when they were there in Cincinnati, and took it home on the Greyhound bus. But the only other guitar I have in my collection is a Yamaha. It's a kind of a fancy Yamaha with thanks written on the back of it.
Thanks, Bill, for sharing your memories of Cincinnati and King Records with us.
Yeah, okay.
Bill Beach, who recorded the single Peg Pants at King Records in June 1956 and has been inducted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame.
There's a boy moved on our street. We call him Crazy Feet, 'cause he likes to dance and wear his tight peg pants. He's cuckoo cat when he wears his tight peg pants. He'll dance all night, oh yes siree. All the girls say he's a boy for me, but don't show 'cause he can really go. Sweet talk, short on the cash. When you don't see him dance, hear him pop and crash. Well, he's got what it takes, and he never puts on his brakes. But he's really neat, the way he moves his feet. He'll dance all night, oh yes siree. All the girls say he's a boy for me, 'cause he likes to dance, wear his tight peg pants. Oh, he likes to dance, the kid with the tight peg. Cat that's come around when he blew in, he shook up the town. Well, he's tall and lean, and he's always on the scene, 'cause he loves to dance, the kid with the tight peg pants. He'll dance all night, oh yes siree. All the girls say he's a boy for me, puts on the show 'cause he can really go. Oh, he loves to dance, the kid with the tight peg pants.
This is Randy McNutt, and I'm here talking with Bonnie Lou, one of my favorites from WLW Radio and WLWT. Bonnie, it's so good to speak with you today.
Well, it's wonderful to speak with you too, Randy.
Well, good.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your early days. I know a lot of people remember you from the Paul Dixon Show, but
right.
You know, I remember years before that when you were singing a lot and, you know, used to crack me up with the things
that
you used to do on TV, and you made a great transition from radio to television.
But yes, I did. I started out on Midwestern Hayride, and because of my yodeling, and my grandmother, she came from Switzerland, and that's how I Swiss yodel. Yodeloo! It came natural, and I lived on a farm.
You were first known as Mary Jo the Yodeling Sweetheart, is that
right? That's right. Yeah. Mary Jo the Yodeling Sweetheart. That's my real name, is Mary Joanne. I'm named after my grandmother Mary and my grandfather Joe. And my mother added the Ann onto it. But that's where I started. And my dad bought me a $2.50 guitar, pawn shop guitar.
How old were you when you started playing?
I was about Let's see, I took violin lessons for about 5 years, and I started out very small, a little tiny violin, so I must have been about five. So I was about 11 years old when my dad got me the guitar.
When did you start singing professionally?
Well, I sang at WJBC in Bloomington at a radio station until I graduated from high school. And then I went to KMBC in Kansas City. I set an audition record. A gentleman named Al Stoss had left WJBC and gone to Kansas City. And so I had some connection there. And I was there almost 2 years. I was 17 years old when I signed that contract. See, I wasn't 18. So I was known as Sally Carson. Gets a little involved, Randy. But anyway, when I came to WLW, because I wasn't 18 when I signed that 5-year contract with KMBC, they said, you can get out of that because you weren't 18, but we're going to change your name. And so Mr. Bill McCluskey, who is Scotch-Irish, he wanted a Bonnie. So that's how we got the name Bonnie Lou.
Okay.
And then I came for an audition record. That's where I really resolved the getting the job, was the audition of singing with Midwestern Hayride. I got a weekend off. KMBC didn't know that, but anyway, so I went and turned in my 2 weeks' notice, and I came to WLW, and I was there for 25 years.
Well, you're working there at the station, and somebody at King Records apparently saw you, and how did that come about with your association with King?
Well, they called me up and asked me if I would come out and do an audition cover record of a song called Seven Lonely Days. Georgia Gibbs had it out in the pop field. So I did my rendition of Seven Lonely Days, and then I did the harmony with the voices. The men did. I had some men sing, Zeke Turner and some. But I did the harmony on that record. I did the harmony on nearly all my records.
Your favorite pastime, making me blue. Last week was the last time I cried for you.
Seven hankies blue I filled with my tears. Seven letters too I filled with my tears. Guess it never pays to make your lover blue.
Darling, you're
seven lonely days make one lonely week.
There's no use in denying.
Seven lonely nights make one lonely me.
It was your favorite
ever since the time you told me we were through.
Last week was the last.
And so they liked my rendition of it, so they hired me to do the record. We were going home, my husband and my little daughter, and we were going back to Illinois, I think, like for Christmas. And I go into this truck stop, and there they're playing Seven Lonely Days. What a thrill, Randy.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know, I thought, wow, I've made it. I'm on a jukebox in a truck stop. It went to number 5 here in the nation, and it was a big record in England and the Netherlands.
It's so interesting to think that you're on local TV here, but you've got a top 5 record in the country. I mean, it's...
I know it.
Did people realize that around here in those days?
I don't think so. And I don't think King Records really wanted me to know it was how popular it was, but I found out.
Well, you're singing country and everything's going great, and suddenly the mid-50s hit and Elvis comes around and the rock sound's coming in. And tell me a bit about how King attempted to recast you as a rockabilly.
You know, I really don't know. I don't think I ever was rockabilly, but that's what they called me. Right, Randy?
Well, that's true. You know, I mean, yeah, a lot of the rockabillys were just country performers.
Yeah, because I'm in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. And also with the Grand Ole Opry. Yes, mm-hmm. I have appeared down there several times.
Well, did when you were at King, did they come to you and say, Bonnie, we'd like to take you in a new direction or something? Or was it just come in and record this song? Or?
No. Sid Nathan would just hear the song, the tapes, you know, the originals, and say, here's what we want you to record. I really didn't have much choice.
So he just had a demo that...
I had a demo record to listen to and some lyrics. And thank goodness I could read music because of taking those years of violin.
You recorded Daddy-O, your big rockabilly hit.
Yes, that's right.
Pop hit. So tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Did the Daddy-O?
Yeah, you recorded that here on Brewster Avenue, right?
Yeah, well, Charlie Gore, who was on Midwestern Hayride, wrote that song, Daddy-O. And Daddy-O, you know, did that little yodel thing. Sure good looking, Daddy-O.
Now,
not so hot this morning.
Did they write that specifically for you and mine?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. It didn't make much waves, but it was a good record.
Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Sure good looking, Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Always cooking, Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Ready to go. All the girls are batty over Daddy-O. You couldn't call him handsome, but he's loaded with style. Always wears a t-shirt and a great big smile. There's something about this crazy kid we all love so. But he's around, the girls will holler, Daddy-O. Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Sure good looking, Daddy-O. Hear him blow. They all jump and holler. Here comes Daddy-O. Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Sure good looking, Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Always cooking, Daddy-O.
Daddy-O.
Ready to go. All the girls are batty over Daddy-O. All the girls are batty over Daddy-O.
Daddy-O. Daddy-O. Daddy-O. Daddy-O. Daddy-O. Daddy-O.
I think it's so interesting about those days that the local TV stars, the public had more access to them. I mean, you could go to the local gym where they're appearing, or one day I saw an old handbill that you were appearing at a hardware store in Oxford.
That's right.
Just as a promotion. I mean, people could come by and meet you. And I mean, today you couldn't get within 50 feet of someone that had a hit record probably.
Yeah. But,
well, as your popularity grew then nationally with this pop hit, what was the reaction of King? They, of course, wanted you to come back with another so-called rockabilly thing. And how did that work out?
I was with a 5-year contract I signed. I went to New York and recorded, but that didn't prove out very good. I don't know. The material wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. Randy, you got to have some good songs, you know?
Did you work with Henry Glover?
I sure did. Mm-hmm. Fine gentleman. Uh-huh.
Well, what was Sid Nathan like to work with?
Oh, he was something else. He'd sit in there. He's quite a healthy man, and he'd sit there with his cigars. And
right behind the board in the
control room? Oh, yeah, behind the board. Oh, yeah. He'd be sitting in there accepting it, or let's do that over again, or that instrument is too loud or something, not loud enough, the drums, and so on. He was the producer of it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, sometimes people say, well, he didn't have much control over the records. He let someone else do them. But, I've heard a lot that he was right there.
Oh, no, he was right there, Randy, all the time.
Well, it was an era that was incredible for the recording and the music. And it's so nice to talk to you today. And I really appreciate you coming in.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you too, Randy, and all our wonderful listeners.
Born in Mississippi in 1932, Charlie Feathers started out as a studio session player at Sun Records in 1954, and from there went on to record his best work at King Records beginning in 1956. From a 1979 interview with him posted on the Rockabilly Hall of Fame's website, in 1956 I cut 8 records for King Records in Cincinnati. I recorded 4 of those at their studio in Cincinnati, Bottle to the Baby, One Hand Loose, I Can't Hardly Stand It, and Everybody's Loving My Baby. I cut the other 4 songs for King at the RCA Victor studio in Nashville. Since Elvis was using the Jordanaires as a backup group, I used a group that had put out a big seller on Sun called Just Walking in the Rain. They were called the Prisonaires, and they were one of the finest groups to work with I have ever known. The tunes we recorded were When You Decide, Nobody's Woman, Too Much Alike, and When You Comin' Round. Charlie Feathers died in Memphis at the age of 86 in 1998.
Well, I kiss my baby and it don't seem right. Too many people been holding her tight. Well, everybody loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. Baby, but I need my baby. Well, I'm
funny, but it carries on while and everybody loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. But me, but don't you see? They got you, boy.
In the fall of 2007, Rusty York dropped by WVXU's studios to talk with Stuart Holman about his work at King Records.
Rusty, welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Just found out that you've got a Harlan County background, and I was born in Pineville and spent most of my summers as a child in Harlan. What about Harlan?
Well, Harlan is just up the road from Pineville.
And how long did you live in Harlan?
Until I moved to Breathitt County.
How old were you then?
Probably 14.
So were you playing bluegrass in Harlan when you were a child? Were you playing before that?
No.
And you started in Breathitt County?
Yes.
And on the guitar, is that right?
Yes.
Let's try to get into the King Records side of your experience, and I'm just real curious to hear what you have to say about that. What was your first contact with Sid Nathan?
Well, one time someone called me, Lou Epstein, from Jimmy Skinner Music Center, and he said, do you know anybody can sing like Buddy Holly? I said, sure.
Who was
so
that?
I was kidding. So it was me.
Yeah, sure. When you say Jimmy Skinner's Music Center, is that a large music store in downtown Cincinnati?
Yes, it was very large. It was at 222 East 5th Street, across from the bus station.
And who was Epstein?
He was the manager of the place, and he died at 39 years mm-hmm. old.
So what did Nathan have in mind when he was looking around for somebody to sing like Buddy Holly?
He wanted to cover Buddy Holly's Peggy Sue.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you'd know why I feel blue without Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Well, I love you, gal. Yes, I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue. Oh, how my heart yearns for you. Oh, 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 Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, gal. Yes, I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue. Pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue. Oh, 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 Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, gal. I need you, Peggy Sue.
I love you, Peggy Sue, with a love so rare and true. Oh, oh, Peggy, and my Peggy Sue. Well, I love you, gal, and I want you, Peggy Sue.
Thank you. Sue. Pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue. Oh, 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 Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Well, I love you, gal, and I need you, Peggy Sue. I love you, Peggy Sue, with a love so rare and true. Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Yes, I love you, gal, and I want you, Peggy Sue. Yes, I love you, gal, and I want you, Peggy Sue.
So you cut Peggy Sue at King Records.
It was 1957.
When you did that session, you were brought in as a singer, and then there were musicians there to play behind you. That had you played with them before? Did you even know those people?
No, no, no. I had not played with them before.
Yeah, you know, Sid was the first, goes down in history as the first person to pretty much develop the concept of studio musicians rather than bringing in your band.
Right, yeah. Right.
And you and Bonnie Lou also worked together at King, did you not?
Yes, about 60.
Did you sing as a duo?
Yes, we did. We did La-Di-Da and Let the School Bells Ring, Ting-a-Ling.
Once again, session musicians there.
I brought a band. I was playing in Columbus, Ohio at the time, and I brought the band down, and I figured out that you don't bring a band in.
Sid was a notch ahead of you on that. He'd already figured it. So that didn't work?
No, it didn't.
So your band, you tried it, didn't work, and you had to make other arrangements.
Well, we recorded with the band, but I never would go back in the studio again with the band.
So let's address rockabilly a little bit. We know what that sounds like and kind of what the instrumentation is and the beat and how that's put together. But I'm just curious, when you were playing rockabilly, was that word floating around?
No, no, not at all. We called it rock and roll.
My shake 'em up, baby, she's the best dancing fool in town. My shake 'em up, baby, she's the best dancing fool in town. Well, she can shake it up right, she can shake it all upside down. She can shake it like a monkey shakes on a coconut tree. She can shake it like a monkey shakes on a coconut tree. She can do the bop, bop's real fine with me. Shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, baby.
baby. Shake 'em up, shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up all the time. Shotgun on the hitch trailer. She can shake it like a rabbit with a shotgun on the hitch trailer. Like an old alley cat when the hound dog grabs his tail. Well, she can strut like a rooster calling on his hen. She can strut like a rooster calling on his hen. Well, if she can do the chicken, all you gotta do is tell her when. Shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, 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 shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up all the time. Shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, shake 'em up, baby. Shake 'em up, baby.
Around Cincinnati, during that period, and we're talking pre-Sugary or right at that time when that style of rock and roll that we now refer to as rockabilly was happening, would you go into clubs and venues like that around Cincinnati, and was that the music that you heard?
Yeah, I heard quite a few of those type songs, but one night I was at the Old Hickory Cafe. I got up on stage and I performed Mystery Train. And I shook my legs and everything, and just making fun of them. And Pat Nelson happened to be there, and he said, oh, we got to do a rock and roll record. The crowd became unglued.
Because of your gyrations and your singing and the style of music. So it was it was overwhelming. And you were doing it as a spoof.
Yes, I was.
And were you playing with the Cajuns at that time?
I had recorded with the Cajuns, but that was later on. Then we went out right away and we cut Red Rooster for one side and the Sugary was the other side. I had the Cajuns with me. We recorded it two or three times.
When you say two or three times, are you talking about a takes in the studio?
Yes.
And tell us about that studio experience on Sugary. Were those studio musicians?
They were the Cajuns.
What was the setup in the studio regarding live and overdubbing? Was there any overdubbing on that record?
No, not at all, because they didn't have overdubbing in those days.
Mm-hmm. Was your drummer in the room with you?
Yes.
So the band went in and set up some microphones, you played the tune, and either it was a take or it wasn't.
Yes.
And did that include the vocals, too?
Yes.
I got a letter from my baby. She said she's coming home today. I got a letter from my baby. She said she's coming home today. Oh, well, my baby wasn't lying. She was coming home to stay. Sugary, sugary. Sugary, sugary. Sugary, sugary. Don't you know I love you so? I got a pencil and a paper. And I sat right down to write. I got a pencil and a paper. And I sat right down to write. I said I miss you in the daytime, but I miss you more at night. Sugary, sugary. Sugary, sugary. Sugary, sugary. Don't you know I love you so? Station. She had her baggage in her hand. Well, I met her at the station. She had her baggage in her hand. I said, I love you, pretty baby. I'll make
make you happy if I can.
Sugary, 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 don't you know I love you so?
How did the selection of Sugary come about?
Pat Nelson, who was my erstwhile manager, said, let's do Sugary. But he first mentioned a few others, like Love Me and Great Balls of Fire. So we decided on Sugary, and I just made the words up. He said, it's going to be the B-side anyway, so just go and do it.
On the spot.
Yes.
Sugary became a major hit record. What was the timing, Rusty, between recording, when you recorded it and when it started to really take off?
We had it out on PJ label, then we sold it to Note, and then we sold it to Chess. We first took it around to everybody, and they said, nah, we don't want that.
What was the time frame in there between when you first cut it and when Chess finally...
A month or two.
That's still pretty rapid.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the Dick Clark tour. What was the timing between Sugary catching on and Dick Clark getting in touch with you and making that tour happen?
Well, he started playing it right away on his American Bandstand. He called me and they said, what do you want to do about this? And I said, well... What do you want to do? And they said, well, we can have you on the Dick Clark Saturday Night Beach Nut Show. And I said, okay, sure.
That was a no-brainer, wasn't it?
Yes.
Also with you there was Duane Eddy.
Yes.
Frankie Avalon.
Yes.
And the renowned Annette Funicello.
Yes.
And were you traveling with your band on that tour? Or was the Dick's tour have a band and you fronted the band?
They had a band, and I only did one number. Sugary.
And that was it?
Yes.
Did you ever appear on the TV show?
Yes, I did.
What about the Hollywood Bowl?
Well, they say that I'm the first one to ever do rock and roll at the Hollywood Bowl. Mm-hmm.
And was that with your band, or was that on the Dick Clark tour?
That was on the Dick Clark tour.
Mm-hmm. You remember that night?
Yes, I do. I remember going to sleep downstairs, and then when I woke up, Dick Clark said, did Rusty York ever show up? And I said, I've been here for hours. So he said, okay, you're ready to do that number.
And was that a crowd that was reacting in a way that was pretty powerful for you?
Yes.
Yeah, they're really enjoying
it. There was flash bulbs popping all over the place.
Wow. Back to the King side of things, we all know that Sid Nathan was his own man, always thinking, always ahead of the pack. I was amazed when I discovered that he had paired you up with Hank Ballard in the Midnighters. What was that all about?
We were pressing at King Records, and I went down to Carl Burkhart's studio one day. So I was pressing some Jewel records. So they were pressing them down there.
Now, let's inform our listening audience here. Carl Burkhart?
Right, Records.
Here in Cincinnati.
Yes.
And when you say you're pressing a Jewel, what you're referring to there is you had done some sessions at your studio, Jewel,
yes.
And you were taking those tapes to King for pressing. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. I was.
And so back to Hank.
When I cut Sugary, Sid Nathan called in Hank Ballard, and they did Sugary, their version of it. So we were pressing there, and they said, sorry.
King was such a blending of cultures, really, and different types of music. An amazing amount of variety came out of there. And one of the things that also happened down there was an amazing blend of blacks and whites at a time when that was a little bit atypical. And reflected in the music, and sessions involve black players and white players and so forth. Did you experience that down there? And I'm just curious, what was the racial situation like in those walls?
There was a lot of tension when I recorded with Hank Ballard's band, and they were drinking apple wine. I said, I'll have some of that. So they were drinking out of half a pint bottles. So I took some and drank it, and sure enough, I started gelling with the band.
It lightened the tension
yes.
in the room a little bit.
Yes.
What'd you record with them?
Tore Up Over You, written by Hank Ballard.
Mm-hmm. And was that released as a single?
Yes, uh-huh. It was. It was Good Night Cincinnati, Good Morning Tennessee
right.
was one of them. And
was Good Night Cincinnati meant to be the A-side? I'm just curious.
Well, who knows? Mm-hmm. Because it had been a hit by a country guy.
Well, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear them eight-wheel drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. I've been from Maine to Frisco, yes, I've traveled everywhere. I've rode the blinds and gone first class when I could pay the fare. There's not a train I didn't ride while I was on the roam. Now show me to an upper berth, cause I'm a-coming home. I've rode the Dixie Flyer, Super Chief, and Santa Fe. The B&O and Chesapeake both put me on my way. Now I'm aboard the Hummingbird, she's humming, yes siree. It's good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. I've been in all the cities, lots of people I have met. But there's one kind of special that I know I can't forget. She'll be waiting at the station with a great big kiss for me. It's good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Well, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear them eight-wheel drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee. Well, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. I'm heading into Nashville just as happy as can be. Hear them eight-wheel drivers rolling, they're talking just to me. They say, good night, Cincinnati, and good morning, Tennessee. They say, good night, Cincinnati, good morning, Tennessee.
Well, what about Bobby Bear?
I fronted the Bobby Bear Band mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Did Bobby Bear do any recording at King?
He recorded All American Boy there.
And that was a pretty good size.
Yes, it was number two.
What other recordings did you do at King? And what about your last session? Do you remember that one or when that might have been?
I recorded Bluegrass at King.
And was that towards the tail end of what you did down there?
Yes. I was going to tell you about the time that I found the audition tapes from King. I was down in Somerset, Kentucky, 200 or 300 miles from Cincinnati. And I came across the tapes that I had made. They were $5 each. There was no CDs in those days.
So you found those for sale in a shop down there?
No, a flea market.
Unbelievable. And needless to say, you brought them all back.
Yes, wow. Yes. And so I put them on, and they broke right away. And, of course, the tape was brittle, but I patched it back together.
And there's been an awful lot of good music that's come out of Jewel over the years, too. And I wanted to mention Lonnie Mack's Whatever's Right was cut out there. And I think part of the Hills of Indiana was cut out there, if I'm not mistaken, too, wasn't it?
He recorded an album with us mm-hmm. that was on Elektra, and that was a big label in those days.
Absolutely. And what's this about the Grateful Dead at Jewel Records?
They came there once.
And was that like just an afternoon session? Were they passing through town, or what was that all about?
They flew in specially for this mm-hmm. session.
Rusty, thanks for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Take care.
Mac Curtis was born in Fort Worth, Texas in 1939 and bought his first guitar at the age of 12. According to the Rockabilly Hall of Fame website, as a teenager in late 1955, he was in a band, and while on stage at a Fort Worth auto dealership, a popular local DJ got the group an audition with a visiting King Records executive, and Mac Curtis was signed immediately. In the spring of 1956, Mac and the band went into the Jim Beck Studio in Dallas for the first of several King Records sessions. As a result, the classic If I Had Me a Woman was released as Mack's first single. It's fun to note that he had a small role in the 2000 movie Don't Let Go, about a legendary rockabilly singer from the 50s and the conflict between him, his wife, and two sons. Mack Curtis passed away in September 2013 at the age of 74 in Texas after a car accident.
Well, if I had me a woman who was big and fat, I'd jump up and down like an alley cat. If I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around. If I had me a woman who was lean and tall, I'd let out with a great big wolf call. If I had me a woman, yeah, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around. Head till I lost my breath, then I'd grab her and I'd squeeze her half to death. If I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around. Now if I had a woman as skinny as a flea, I'd be as happy as a monkey in a tree. If I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around. Down and I'd turn a few flips and I'd grab her and I'd kiss her on her pretty sweet lips. If I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around. Now if I had me a woman who was big and fat, I'd look up and down like an alley cat. If I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, if I had me a woman, I wouldn't be roaming around.
You've been listening to a special highlighting some of the musicians who recorded rockabilly songs for King Records. You'll find a link at WVXU.org. I'd like to thank Stuart Holman, Randy McNutt, Brian Powers, and Rick Andrus for their help with this program. I'm producer and host Lee Hay, and you're listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.